The BBC presents A Novelist and His Public, a talk in which Joyce Carey considers his relationship with the people to whom his work is offered.
The best idea of a novelist's public that I ever heard of came from a reader who told me that he hated my new book and knew he would hate it. And when I asked him why he'd read it, he said in a melancholy way that he was one of my oldest public. A novelist public, in fact, is people who read everything he writes, even when they hate it. They're like those friends who come to us even when we have bad colds or are in a bad temper. They're almost like wives and husbands who marry for better or worse. Because the relation is essentially mutual. It's a relation of two persons. The reader knows more or less what to look for in that writer. He has, so to speak, got his wavelength and can tune in. And what he gets from the writer is the writer's meaning, or at least he gets the meaning that writer has for him. Now, how does a writer get a public? He has to write in the first place and go on writing, at least as long as any publisher will publish him, and he has to mean something. If he does really mean what he writes and manages somehow to put it over, he will in the end almost certainly find himself with a public. And usually it will be there before he knows it. It may amount only to a dozen or two, for if they are really his public, they usually imagine that he's got thousands of readers and they wouldn't dream of writing him a letter. So it may be years before he discovers that he has what publishers call a public, that is, this certain number of people who read whatever he writes, and who, if he does chance to meet one of them, will actually talk about his characters as if they were discussing actual living people. They'll even argue with him about them. I've been told by such a reader that I hadn't been fair to a certain woman. A woman, of course, it's invented by myself. I was told I didn't really understand her. And what that reader had to say was not only extremely interesting to me, it was important. The most valuable kind of criticism. Now, this is exactly the intimate mutual relation of friends who discuss a common interest. It is just the same relation for every kind of author, Ethel M. Dell as well as Henry James. Of course, I know there's a whole lot of people who make a pretty sharp distinction between the bestseller and what they call the serious writer. The idea apparently is that the writer writes, the latter, the serious writer writes, in order to express very serious feelings about the world, but the bestseller starts with the intention of being a bestseller. He's a chap who says to himself, I'll give the public what it wants and make millions. And of course, certain writers do just that. Now, I doubt very much if anyone can set out to be a bestseller. I know some bestsellers take a very careless tone about their own works, as if they didn't mean anything by them, as if they did them just for fun and wrote them with their left hands in the dark, as they say, while thinking of something else. But I just can't swallow it. I don't believe any author ever got a public unless he writes what he believes. He may, of course, put up a kind of false front to catch some section of what he thinks is popular taste, but this will certainly come out in the book. No writer can hide behind his book, I'm sure of that. And people who want the feel of complete honesty and conviction in the books they read will dislike that author. They may read him, but they won't join his public. Every writer has readers, casual readers, who don't belong to his public and never will. The only people I can think of who get a public and make money by writing as a purely commercial job are detective story writers. And detective stories are a special box of tricks. They're just that. After all, murder is a fairly serious matter if it happens to real people, even in a book. The detective writer, therefore, can't from the start believe in his own people. His murderee, like his murderer, is simply a move in a game. He doesn't want the sympathy of his reader. He's got actually to avoid it. But the novel writer must excite sympathy. Never mind if he's writing satire, the reader must feel for his characters all the time. Now, how does a young writer fail to get a public? We've said how he gets one, how does he fail to get one? The only real way is to be a bore. And he's warned every day that the best way to be a bore is to write a novel of ideas. Now, it's perfectly true that a novel, like all art, is aimed at the feelings. It's got to be an experience. So far as it deals directly in ideas, there must be ideas, therefore, that convey feeling. Of course, most ideas in real life do excite a lot of feeling. Political ideas start wars. Religious ideology, as we all know, is the very devil for making trouble in the world. But there have to be politics and religion to give form to that world. We don't need to swallow the whole of a party's politics or the whole of a church's creed, but they have to be there to give that party and that church a form, otherwise they wouldn't exist. And it's good for us that they should be there to define our own position. They make sense and order in the chaos of actual events. Look at any newspaper and you see what chaos actual events are. We need them, therefore, to make sense of our own lives. And a novelist is no different from other people in this way. He has to have ideas to write at all, to make his characters act like reasonable people, to make sense of his plot, and to give the whole book a form. Meaning is form, and form is meaning. Unless you know what you mean, you can't write a book at all. When people damn a novel of ideas, they are really complaining that the ideas stick out on their own account, that they don't have enough influence on the lives of the people in the book. So that novel is not a story about people, but it's mere propaganda, and it's therefore a bore. Another thing they say to young novelists, if you want a public, don't moralise, because morals are a bore. But in fact, all good novels, and especially popular novels, are about morals. We can see that in the case of Miss Dale again. A good novel is about what people do and why they do it and how it succeeds in making them happy or otherwise, and these are all moral questions. The idea that there's something aloof and dull about a novel that takes morals seriously is completely wrong. The truth is just the other way around. Popular tales and the folklore of simple people, of people who never saw a novel, of primitive tribesmen in Africa, what are they but highly moral, all of them? All gossip is about conduct, and that is why it's so fascinating. Listen to any two old char ladies conversing together. Their talk's all about people, and it's full of judgments about right and wrong, what people ought to do and what they ought to feel, for the very good reason that it's intensely important to them and their happiness that people should have some standards of right and wrong. The novel reader may belong to Ethel M. Dell's public, or he may prefer Conrad and James and Lawrence, but what he is interested in from first to last is conduct. That is to say, morals. And the greatest writers in the world are just those, of course, who take the greatest interest in morals. It's because of that that they are so exciting to read. You've only got to think of Dickens and Tolstoy, or Hardy, Conrad, almost any of them. Now, of course, these writers know that moral theories are nothing by themselves, that they're only significant in action, in character. They don't preach, and if they did preach, they would bore. Now, half juvenile delinquency, that is, most of crime, starts in boredom. Boys and girls of 12 to 18 have the most terrific energy and much too little to do with it. They also have the most lively and eager imaginations, for which almost nothing is provided. If they show any imagination in dress, for instance, like the Teddy Boys, they are promptly marked down as rebels and nuisances, and respond very naturally by rebelling. If they show any interest in reading, it's odds on that the books will be labelled obscene and thrown on the fire, and then it is highly likely that they will stop reading altogether and simply get on with gangsterism. To prevent anyone on earth reading what he wants to read, what he chooses for himself, is a very serious responsibility for any kind of authority. The most significant thing about young criminals is that so many can't read and don't want to begin. They've been put off, so that you wonder if books were ever read to them in childhood and what kind of books, to make the very idea of reading a bore to be dodged. All children adore to have interesting stories read to them. They are almost all potential readers, and reading for a good many of them is their only chance of any real education. It's the only kind, anyhow, that goes on for life among all classes. Most people by the age of 25 are quite impervious to any kind of teaching. But if they've got the reading habit, they will read for amusement. They will even spend money on a book. And they will often go on from simple yarns, sex stories, thrillers, suitable to their age, to the very greatest writers. It's completely wrong to think the public of a serious writer consists only of university graduates and what are called the white-collar men. There aren't any university or class distinctions among readers. Ask librarians, ask writers. They get the most penetrating, the most intelligent letters from people who certainly never went to a university, from struggling housewives writing on the kitchen table between the stove and the washtub. A book, as I say, is an experience. A great book is a very deep, a very powerful experience. Why shouldn't people whose lives are hard lived and hard felt understand what Tolstoy or James mean for them? I know a docker and his wife who read James, who read all the classics and enjoy them intensely. They live in a prefab, but they're on intimate terms with some of the most interesting, the most exciting minds that ever existed. A novelist public is not a class public. Great scholars often read tripe because they're tired, their minds are tired, and very simple people enjoy the masters. And what's more, they can enjoy a variety of masters. They can belong to many different publics. Reading, like appetite, is a matter of mood. I have a shelf full of masterpieces, specially chosen to be completely different in character and so to suit different moods. Peacock stands beside Melville, Proustnik's Genji, Compton Burnett beside Svevo, and Brighton Rock and Middlemarch make another pair, and so on. Every kind of quality. All of our opposites. And I've read all this shelf so often I can almost open almost any book anywhere and know where I am in the story and what the people are doing there and what they're feeling. I enter at once, therefore, into the author's private world, the world he has created for himself. I meet him again in this world in his own character and his own meaning. In fact, of course, we don't know anyone so well as we know some of the great authors, because they're all people with a special power of expression, and they're all trying to give us an experience which has been important to them. They're trying to make us see and feel the world as they've felt it. When I join their publics, I form at once the closest kind of relation of mutual interest that I could get anywhere else. Even my best friends are not always at home or free to see me when I most need to see them, but a book and its author are always at hand. I can be happy and excited with them alone anywhere in the world.
That talk by Joyce Carey on A Novelist and His Public was presented by the BBC.